You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up, Colombia's government has finally approved a deal to end its 50-year conflict with FARC rebels. What will it mean for the country? Also ahead.
There's a reason the Wall Street donors are giving tens of millions of dollars to my opponent. Hillary Clinton is the voice for global special interests.
Donald Trump had nothing good to say about Wall Street during his presidential campaign. So why is he promoting so many former bankers to his cabinet? And
there is such a rich thesaurus now of things that I've said that have been one way or another, through what alchemy I do not know, somehow misconstrued, that it would really take me too long to engage in a full global itinerary of apology to all concerned.
We'll also be discussing whether Britain's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, has given up on diplomacy to concentrate on selling his latest book. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Jacob Parakilis, who's assistant head of the US and Americas program at Chatham House, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com and also a foreign affairs analyst. Welcome both to the program.
Thank you.
Colombia's Congress has finally approved a revised peace deal that will end a 50-year conflict between the country's government and the FARC rebel group. The first peace accord was rejected in a national referendum, but the public won't be asked for their opinion on the revised agreement. It's been pushed through by the country's Senate. Jacob, a wise decision to, after all the horrible things we've seen happening with referendum, to turn your back on the people?
It's, in terms of getting the peace agreement signed, it was clearly the right decision. In terms of the precedent it sets, it's not clear. I mean, I think what you'll see in Colombia is probably a resurgence of Alvaro Uribe and his compatriots as they argue that the will of the people was subverted by elected leaders. You may see a sort of realignment in Colombian politics as a result, or it may be that the peace deal will simply be very successful and that people will decide that this was ultimately the right thing to do, and the manner in which it was passed will slide into history.
Well, the former president Alvaro Uribe, his shtick, like many other people in Colombia, is that there's not enough punishment, there's not enough recognition of the terrible things that happened under the FARC. And do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think it's a fair criticism because, he's right that there isn't punishment. But when you look at successful post-conflict resolutions, a lot of them aren't really punitive. You have truth and reconciliation commissions. There's a lot of models of post-conflict governance that aren't about punishment. They're just about sort of letting the truth be known and trying to come to some shared understanding of history. I think one of the things that we're seeing globally this year is that when you don't have a shared understanding of history, when you don't have a shared understanding of the way the world works, you can't proceed with any basis from that. So the baseline for having a sort of political future is agreeing a set of facts. And if there's a mechanism in place that the rebels and the establishment and the sort of people in between can all agree on what happened and move forward, then that, I think, is ultimately the more important part than any kind of post-conflict retributive justice.
Tim, it looked like you wanted to dive in there.
Well, I was just agreeing with most of it, but I was just thinking to myself, if you want to have a total victory in a war, and it absolutely was a war, 220,000 people killed, well, if you want to have total victory, you better bring a nuclear weapon. And I don't think that's a very good idea, bringing a nuclear weapon. Consequently, what you end up with is what you end up with nearly all wars, and that's a compromise, and that's what this is. The previous one was put to the people and very, very narrowly rejected, which was a surprise to everybody. And it's almost in that category of these 2016 upsets because the polls said it would go through. I accept that, yes, now Congress has simply just rubber stamped it, but there were 50 different parts of the original agreement which only just failed to get through, which have now been rewritten. I agree also that the war crimes, and that's what they were that were committed, but they were committed by both sides, will not now go to a tribunal. And because I'm an outsider, and I don't have the emotion in the game. I just think that the compromise, which is what this is probably for the best if it sticks.
And, Jake, when you look at, you know, an example closer to home, Northern Ireland, which, you know, we live through on this island, there was an agreement with, you know, the IRA and with the terror groups in Northern Ireland to put down their arms, to enter into the democratic process. And I guess what's interesting then, I wonder if you'd put that to British people, you know, you mainlanders. I don't think that many mainlanders would have been comfortable putting a tick next to a question that said, I give something to the IRA. They would have found it so distasteful, it was impossible. But in the end, it was the right thing to do because it has delivered peace. And again, coming back to this notion of sometimes... Is it sometimes just better not to, midterm, go and ask the public what they want? Sometimes do you need moral leaders who push things through and then let them bed in?
I mean, this is the fundamental question of democracy, because you don't want to be in the position of saying, let's not give the public a voice, let's not give them a vote. We, the elites, know what we're doing and we will dictate to you, because, down that path lies sort of technocratic authoritarianism and ultimately just authoritarianism. And by the same token, you don't want to put absolutely everything to popular vote, because frankly, most people are busy living their lives. They don't have time to look at the sort of consequences and aspects of retributive versus restorative justice. They don't have time to examine the sort of nuances of tax policy. That's why you have experts. So the fundamental question of democracy, which I think is what we're really struggling with this year, is where do you find that balance between populism, between sort of direct democracy and representative democracy? And I think what you've seen this year is that what we thought we had a fairly good balance, and turns out we don't.
Tim, whatever people now think of British Prime Ministers John Major and Tony Blair, they did some pretty brave things to make that deal come to pass. Do you think that in most countries where there is terrorist campaigns, heads of government should speak to terrorists?
Yes, because I think that sometimes wise heads do prevail. I mean, often they don't. But I also am more in favor of the representative democracy model, not the direct democracy. And that is because of the reasons just laid out. We give our votes and our support to these people. They go, and at the very top end, they make decisions. If we then fundamentally disagree with it, or if those decisions prove to be wrong, we kick the rascals out. I just think it's a more, it gets stuff done, and stuff needs to be done. Inertia needs to be broken. That is what they've done here. They did put it to the people. In a sense, they listened to the people, because they've said, all right, we've realized that you think this has gone too far towards FARC. Most of the 50 compromises made have been made by FARC. It probably would just tip over this time. I mean, we don't know, because of the changes, that they probably would vote for it. But it is this fundamental thing about democracy. And I just think people's lives are too busy. And as I said, we do have, thankfully, the ability to kick the rascals out in 4 years' time.
Can I tip one slightly philosophical question your way, Jacob? I think what's interesting is when you watch someone like the Queen, she would end up in situations in recent years in rooms with people who had led the political wing of the IRA, an organization with a political front of somebody who put a bomb on a boat and killed a relative of hers, Lord Louis Mountbatten.
And a child that was on the boat as well.
And a child that was on the boat. And here's a woman who, has every reason to turn her back, but, manage to shake hands and be pleasant and have a cup of tea. Does it surprise you, not using her as an example, but when we look at all these situations, the human ability for, whether forgiveness is the right word, but for moving on, it's kind of amazing, isn't it?
It is. And you can, going to an example that's sort of closer to my area of study, you can look at the relationship between John McCain and Vietnam. Here's a guy who was shot down on a bombing mission over Vietnam, was held in prison, tortured, beaten for 5 years, submerged in cold water for a large part of that, underwent unimaginable suffering, and then led the charge to normalize U.S. relations with Vietnam and made numerous official and unofficial visits to the country and sort of, met with people who had imprisoned him. And just the ability to sort of look past what was done in war and to not even necessarily forgive, because I don't have any experience like that. I can't speak to whether forgiveness is feasible or possible, or what it means to forgive under the circumstances. But to compartmentalize that, to say this is part of the human experience, which is separate from our day-to-day lives, and this is a war, and that's a separate thing.
And to be rational rather than only emotional. Mandela's in the same ballpark. It's a dirty word in many people's lexicon, but I love the word compromise.
Can I ask you just one question, Tim? You've done lots of reporting in the Middle East, and we've seen the hell that is being played out in Syria. Now, when people talk about that, they say there are divisions that will never be healed, that there are lines that have been crossed that will never be forgotten. But even there, do you think that, time... people meeting, people return. I wonder if people returning to villages. We're seeing already some Christians returning to villages which have been taken back off of ISIS, and they're returning, and they are amongst people that they don't know what they thought and did during the period of ISIS, but they're already beginning to give it a go. Do you think there is potential there for a healing of the wounds and
no.
and a more mixed state?
Sadly, I don't. Two reasons. One. Is the sheer passage of time, which doesn't, time can be a healer, but it's a very, very long passage of time that is a healer. And I'll give the example of Yugoslavia, where the ghosts were woken up after only 40 years after the Second World War. That's one. And the other is you've got this added problem in the Middle East, and this is difficult territory, but there is absolutely a blood feud culture. I mean, it still exists in the mountains in parts of Greece. You shoot my brother, I have to kill one of your family. And it is deeply embedded, especially in the rural population. If you have killed any members of my family, I am honor bound to kill many members of yours. And I think that is so deep rooted, I see very little chance of putting Syria back together. And the federal option is probably the best compromise, but I'm not even sure about that.
Just one just an odd reflection, and you're sitting here in London, and I'm often struck, I live in a bit of central London, which, the architecture of it or how it's put together is all down to bombing in the Second World War. If there's a modern building in the row, it was taken out at some point, by the Luftwaffe. But then again, you only had to go like 20 years, and Londoners were, amongst Germans coming on holiday. Again, I'm amazed at, especially for cities, the ability to heal and regenerate. When you think how many times London has been flattened, bombed, destroyed, all sorts of things happened, it's always kind of these cities do fight back.
You may have something in what you say, Andrew, about cities, but London is not Britain.
And the countryside in Syria, you think, is not a Damascus that might be
exactly
bullish enough to
where many of them live together, and in Damascus, many of them still live together in the areas that they haven't divided as much as elsewhere.
Well, no, I know you know well, but just a side story. We were in Dubai. We recently met somebody who is a fascinating guy who has written a piece in the upcoming forecast for us, and. He is a Christian who has left and gone to Dubai, but at the weekends is still going back to Damascus, flying in on to go and see his mom, going out for dinner, going to bars, going to clubs with a friend who has Jewish heritage who still lives in Damascus, and Muslim friends of all sorts of faith. So there you think, I wonder whether these tugs and ties could be pulled back together.
No, he's at a higher level. The very fact that he's on a plane means he's at a higher level. He's at a highly educated, probably understands this, probably is not part of that tribal system which still holds sway once you leave the cities.
Well, we're going to move on to a different topic even. Let's remind ourselves of what Donald Trump had to say about bankers during his presidential bid.
There's a reason the Wall Street donors are giving tens of millions of dollars to my opponent. Hillary Clinton is the voice for global special interests. I'm running to be the voice of the forgotten men and women of this country. Believe me, they are forgotten.
Indeed, President-elect Trump spent a lot of his campaign complaining about what he called special interests. Why then is the billionaire businessman so eager to promote former Wall Street insiders to his cabinet? Jacob, I think you've got the answer. Please tell me.
Well, this is, there's an interesting sort of dichotomy here, and that's that Trump represents not only the sort of, he's cast himself as the voice of the common man, but he is an elite in the deepest sense of the word. His father was a wealthy real estate developer. He, you know, he said, oh, I started with a small $1 million loan. It was actually $14 million. And frankly, most of us will never see $14 million in our lives. I mean, Trump started at the very top, but he's always cast himself as an outsider, even when he's not. And he was played as an outsider or sort of as this voice of, you know, slightly grumpy reason in The Apprentice for seasons upon seasons on television in the U.S. And that reinforced the perception that he was sort of a competent business outsider. And there's always this strand in U.S. politics, the idea that if only we could run the government like a business, we should need people who aren't politicians. And Trump, you know, was not a politician. He is now, and he's coming in at the very top, and he is turning to the people. And if there's anything that binds together most of his cabinet appointments, it's people that he's comfortable with, it's people that he knows, it's people from the world that he knows. So Steve Mnuchin, for example, is somebody that Trump knows. He was his finance chair. He doesn't have experience running a government agency. He doesn't have experience working in a government agency, but to Trump's way of looking at it, here's somebody who's good with money, here's somebody I know, here's somebody who will be loyal to me, and as a result, he will do what I say, and he will run the Treasury Department in a way that I want him to.
And Tim, when you see these appointments, you know, are we just to begin, you know, like everything else with Trump, just to take it with a pinch of salt, anything he's ever said? Or, you know, was he tapping into something genuine and real? Because, you know, it's not much of an accusation to say Hillary, you know, made speeches to bankers. That was enough to kind of tarnish her image.
Yeah. So, and her husband, you know, the first thing he did when he signed off from the presidency was to go off and make enormous amounts of money.
But that isn't, you know, when you put it next to Trump, whose sole ambition seems to have been to make enormous amounts of money, it seems strange that he was criticizing Wall Street or getting away with criticizing Wall Street for the very thing that he's, you know, he loves to do himself.
I'm going to have to engage in some mental gymnastics, but I don't think that
I can follow you.
They're that difficult to do. Let's take Mnuchin, for example, at the Treasury, and let's take Trump. You mentioned the word elite, and they absolutely are the elite, but they're not the establishment. That is a different thing. And so it is possible to be elite, to be rich, to be one of the haves, but not be part of the establishment. And he is outside of the establishment in that respect, certainly the political establishment, just as Nigel Farage in this country, very wealthy businessman, but he's not part of the political establishment. That's the first thing. The second thing is that in American thought, notably in the right-of-center American thought, The idea of making money and of business is entirely a positive thing. In European thought, absolutely on the left, it's a bit grubby and we don't like it and we're a bit nervous about it. And that even is part of some people on the right. In America, it's far, far less. And so if you've got Wilbur Ross at Commerce, Mnuchin at the Treasury, Education Betsy DeVos, who's a billionaire, Transport Elaine Chao, a billionaire, to the American right, and that's not embarrassed about business and making money, you're thinking, these are guys that can get in there and do something for business. And it was Mnuchin who said, and this is a hostage to fortune, he said, I want to see, I think it was 3 to 4% growth. Okay, if you can get 3 to 4% growth, I'm going to be better off. And that's why with this mental gymnastics, you can be anti-establishment, but still in the elite.
Elaine Chao, as far as I know, is not actually a billionaire. She's actually one of the few long-term public servants in the incoming Trump administration.
Betsy DeVos?
No, Elaine Chao.
Elaine Chao is married to Mitchell McConnell.
Yeah.
Elaine Chao is on the board of News Corp.
That doesn't make her a billionaire. No, she's one of the, because she was Deputy Secretary of Transportation. She was Secretary of Labor in the Bush administration. She's one of the few people who has sort of high-level government experience within the Trump, incoming Trump team.
Jacob, there was a suggestion in the New York Times that we shouldn't think of the arrival of Donald Trump as the arrival of a Republican in the White House, but rather the arrival of the first independent president for a very long time. Hearing the discussion about the people who are being appointed to his cabinet and the way that he's selecting them, is he choosing them along actually tight, you know, political lines with a clear theory about where he wants to head? Or is he putting together, actually, he's chosen a couple of Democrats. Is he trying to put together something that is just, as you say, people he kind of likes and thinks he'll get on with?
He so far, his choices suggest they're not exactly the choices that Ted Cruz would have made. They're not exactly the choices that Marco Rubio would have made. But they're entirely in keeping with a sort of right-wing version of Republicanism. And he's not – there was a version of Trump in the late 90s, the early 2000s, that was sort of a reformist, pragmatic, pro-choice, pro-gun control, pro-confiscatory wealth taxes even. He was very sort of ideologically flexible and would have read as a moderate Republican then and sort of as, you know, almost a Democrat now. He's given up on all those positions. And his appointments so far suggest – I mean, you know, the one from the left-wing point of view, his best appointment so far has been Nikki Haley as UN ambassador. And this is someone who doesn't have foreign policy experience. She doesn't have a clear record on foreign – you know, she was a governor and by all accounts a competent governor. And somebody who certainly did very well in a couple of controversial issues, notably the post-Charleston shooting Confederate flag controversy. But she's not, you know, this isn't somebody who Hillary Clinton would have picked.
I'd concur with all that. Yeah, I mean, it is to her credit that she basically said that the Confederate flag is coming down above the South Carolina governor's house because the guy that shot all these people flew it and it's time to end. And Obama was very, very happy about that. Sorry, the only thing I would add is that I agree with everything it said. And she is the only one outside of that group. But it's an important position, but it's not up there with Treasury and Transport and Secretary of State.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, you're listening to Majority House. Coming up next, we're going to be discussing a land swap between Belgium and the Netherlands and also looking if there's ever an inopportune time to promote your latest book. Stay tuned.
Monocle invites you to raise a glass of Glühwein at the annual Monocle Christmas Market. Please join us for this winter wonderland of a weekend, complete with warming treats from the Monocle Cafe, reindeer petting, and an appearance from Monochan the Owl, all set to a cheery playlist. You can also try your hand at our ever-popular tombola and meet our VIP Santa Claus all the way from Rovaniemi. The 2016 Monocle Christmas Market on Saturday the 3rd and Sunday the 4th of December from 11 a.m. to 1700 at our Midori House HQ here in Marylebone. Find all the details at monocle.com. We ho ho, hope to see you there.
Well, still with me. We're not going to comment on the adverts. Well, still with me are Tim Marshall and Jacob Parakilis. Now, Belgium and the Netherlands have always enjoyed quite a mature relationship, but earlier this week they agreed to something quite unusual. The neighbours are to swap small, uninhabited bits of land. Tim, why are they doing this?
It's not unusual. Particularly for people to do this sort of thing. For example, the Americans and Mexico have come to a very equitable arrangement on the Rio Grande River, which was somebody dug a trench out of it in 1905, and then somebody else noticed 60 years later that, hang on a minute, you've got about 150 yards of our territory. And they just rewrote the treaty, and it was all fine. I'm thinking of other ones. India and Bangladesh are busy doing a bit of land swaps. Bolivia was given access to the sea by, I think it was Peru. Bosnia, part of Bosnia is about 1,000 yards wide, where it cuts out of Croatia so they can also get to the sea, etc., etc. These are wonderful examples, and this is another one of how to do it. Against that, I'm afraid I can give you several hundred years of wars which people have tried to do it by force.
Well, I would bring in Jacob here, but I want to fit in the final topic because the UK's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, has made a career out of embarrassing himself on the world stage. He called Hillary Clinton a sadistic nurse, made fun of President Obama's heritage, and penned a rude poem about Turkey's president. That's a good CV, isn't it, for a foreign minister if you're in the UK? But on a recent official trip to Belgrade, Johnson appeared to give up pretending that he was a politician altogether. Reports suggest that he spent time in Serbia's capital trying to flog his latest book. Tim, you've written rather a lot of books. Did you have some sympathy?
No. And this is me being harsh to a fellow author. Because although, yes, on one level, you should never pass up the opportunity to promote your books. For example, my new one is called Worth Dying For, The Power and Politics of Flags. The previous one was called Prisoners of Jock. Anyway, but this is different. This is the Secretary of State of the United Kingdom. And he went off to Serbia. He's got a new book out. I've actually bought it, but I haven't read it. Churchill, The Churchill Factor. Now, he swears blind, and the Foreign Office says, no, we didn't know when we went to the bookshop that there would be a cardboard cutout of Churchill for him to pose next to, nor did we know there'd be a big pile of books that he could then sign and then talk in a Q&A. All that, the Foreign Office says, was a complete surprise to them. So I did minutes of deep investigatory journalism. I went to Tanjug, the former Yugoslav and now Serbian news agency, and on the 4th of November, Tanjug said, Johnson is expected to take part in a discussion about his book, The Churchill Factor, at this bookshop. Now, you know as well as I do that the British Embassy reads every single thing that is in the Serbian press about the Foreign Office and the Foreign Secretary. So the Foreign Office knew on the 4th or 5th of November that this was planned. He visited on the 12th of November, and today they're saying, we had no idea.
Jacob, on the broader topic of Johnson's kind of reign so far as Foreign Secretary, is he making a good job? He seems to have tried to keep his mouth shut, but he doesn't. It's too difficult for him.
I think on the sort of frequency of gaffe scale, he is, for the last 6 months, I think he's certainly been behind Trump. He's been behind Biden, which is saying something. Biden's gaffes tend to be more in the category of, you know, slightly endearing awkwardness rather than deeply offensive. And he gets a pass on some of the leaning towards offensive things that he says because, I mean, you can construct a kind of gaffe personality. And I think Biden's has worked better for him than Johnson's. I haven't been aware of any spectacular gaffes from Johnson in the last few months. And after there's a video which is quite amazing of the State Department in the U.S. their spokesperson being told in real time during a press conference that Johnson had been named.
Oh, yes.
And he was very professional, but he clearly struggled to maintain his composure before saying the usual sort of the Foreign Secretary will remain one of the great assets for American British diplomacy.
Blah,
we look
blah,
forward
blah.
To working with him. But there was clearly a moment where he thought, can I just please just turn the cameras off for a second so I could laugh? But he was very, and I think that sort of, you know, the straight-faced, let's just look past all of the awkward things that he said in the past and proceed with diplomacy has worked, at least in the US-UK relationship.
Tim, I read a story this week that friends of his had been suggesting that it was time that those around him, other fellow Tories, should stop making jokes at his expense because it was diminishing his stature on the world stage.
It's
and
true.
They'd even said that Theresa May, you know, had too many kind of pops at him in speeches and things. And do you think that, you know, that that's the problem? No matter how much he shuts up, he is a comic character.
Yeah. Remember when John Prescott, a former deputy leader of the Labour Party, when he was the deputy prime minister under the Blair government, he punched somebody in a crowd. It was a very, very good punch, it was too, because he used to be an amateur boxer. And I think it was Tony Blair or his spokesman said, well, you know, John will be John. But I thought Prescott could get away with that. But I don't think Boris can get away with playing the clown. And I agree with you. I think he has been undermined by some of the jokes that are made by his own side. Mrs. May made a very, very good joke about him, which undermined him at a recent media dinner. And I think it does diminish the state, the great office of state. But the last thing is that he doesn't help himself sometimes. He was with the Germans and he made some sort of crass joke and the German guy just looked at him silently. And it wasn't good.
Jacob, is his big kind of hope, actually, your new president? Because in a way, I think he's going to kind of out Johnson at every step, isn't he?
It will be an interesting first meeting because Johnson famously said of Trump, the only reason I would tell people not to go to New York is the very real risk of meeting Donald Trump, which was... in the abstract, you could say quite a good line, but it's going to complicate matters the first, I think, state visit or state dinner. But, Johnson also, I think, managed, you know, if he could get past John Kerry, if he can sort of, you know, smooth things over with American diplomats, I think he will probably manage to find some way to communicate effectively with Trump.
Well, I must say that none of you put your foot in it today. Tim and Jacob, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. But I'm afraid that's all we have time for. The show was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also by Maria Khan. And our studio manager and the man keeping us on air was Kieran Banerjee. More music next, and then at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist. I wonder who presents that. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, but from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.